Part 4. Conscription. It was amazing, Gina thought, just how quickly governments could jump when they wanted to. Within 5 hours of the destruction of the 2 slave ships, not only was the link to the nearest deep space transceiver open again, allowing information to once more flow freely into Galantos from the local subspace network, but Counselor Joboth had emerged from his pressing business on the far side of the planet, professing his deep and undying loyalty to the Galactic Alliance. Jaina could imagine her father's reaction to that. Her mother would have no doubt shared his sentiments, too, but hid her feelings beneath a more gracious and temperate response. Her parents worked well that way, maintaining a pretense guaranteed on the one hand to intimidate the most ingratiating of local governors, but at the same time capable of wooing them without actually using force. Jaina hadn't seen the exchange, though. After docking with Pride of Salonia and having a few minor bruises treated, she had retired to one of the frigate's berths and slept solidly for almost 5 hours. It had been cramped and uncomfortable, but it was better than trying to sleep upright in her X-wing, even though she'd had hundreds of hours practice doing just that over the years. In her deep sleep, she had dreamed fitfully of Anakin's last mission to the world ship around Mirker to destroy the Voxen Queen, as well as the cold fury she had felt upon his death that had turned her for a time to the dark side. While her body rested, her mind relived the fear that Jason, too, had died, and the aftertaste of that awful grief she would carry with her for the rest of her life, she was sure. But even as she was dreaming, she found herself wondering, why now? Why here? What is the dream trying to tell? She woke with a start, sucking air in sharply as a hand gripped her shoulder and shook. What? She rolled over, eyes blinking open to peer up at the dark blur leaning over her. Relax, Jaina. It's just me. Through the haze of sleep, she recognized Jag's solid, calming presence as he sat down on the edge of the narrow bunk beside her. Jag? She sat up, brushing loose strands of hair back from her face. She yawned, knuckling her eyes. You want to be careful, you know. People will talk. Let them, he said. Besides, you do know where you are, don't you? It sank in then that she wasn't in her quarters on Mon Calamari, but instead tucked into a space in a communal bunk room, with little more than a flimsy curtain separating her bunk from the 15 other identical beds. She had a better chance of finding a Kowakian monkey lizard at the helm of a starship than of getting any privacy here. "Why are you waking me up?" she asked after orienting herself. "Has anything happened?" "No," he said, laughing. "You requested a standard field nap, and I volunteered to do the dirty work when time came to wake you up. It was my opinion that the duty officer should be spared the grisly business." He smiled. "I don't see why he should get to have all the fun." Her mouth half opened to snap a retort, but the unexpected compliment threw her for a second. Then she shook her head and smiled also. What do you really want, Jag? If it's a rematch on the dueling mat, then you're going to have to at least give me a minute or two to wake up properly. He laughed again. Actually, I came to bring you some news, he said. About Jason. Jason? The last vestiges of sleep vanished. She sat up fully. Alarm spiking at the back of her brain. Was this why those memories had surfaced? Tell me, she grated. Jag did tell her. She learned of Counselor Joboth's turnaround and the reopening of communications. Although she was relieved that the situation on Galantos had been so easily rectified, that was nothing compared to the news that had been relayed from Mon Calamari once they had regained contact. The Yuuzhan Vong invasion of the Empire had been successfully resisted. After the destruction of Bastion, Imperial forces had successfully turned the invaders back at Borosk and were at the moment forcing them to fight a rearguard action as they retreated. Mara and Luke's mission had been instrumental in the victory, supplying tactics and pivotal aid where required. Rumor had it that they may even have saved Grand Admiral Pelion's life in the process. And Jason was fine. A moment's examination of the part of her that resonated with her twin would have told her that there was nothing wrong with him. no matter how far apart they were, and at that moment there was more than half a galaxy between them, she would always know if he was in trouble. She nudged Jag off the bunk, and he turned his back to her as she slid out from under the covers. Jaina quickly slipped her flight uniform on over her underclothes, silently promising herself a serious shower at the earliest opportunity. "You can turn around now." "Where are you planning to go?" he asked. "You're still off duty, remember? Your parents are asleep. Your fighter is being repaired." She faced him, hands on hips. "Then why wake me in the first place? Couldn't that news have waited until I had woken up by myself?" "Well, I just thought..." He fell silent, clearly embarrassed. "Maybe you really did want that rematch," she said lightly. Then she took his arm and led him out of the crew quarters. "For now, though, let's just walk, okay? Even if it's only as far as the mess, I have a feeling I'm going to be ravenous once all of me wakes up." She was right. Barely had they entered the cramped main access corridor running along the spine of the frigate when her stomach began to rumble and she had a terrible craving for one of the alpha protein drinks Lando Calrissian had taught her to enjoy when she was younger. Pride of Salonia's cook droid had a limited repertoire, however, and she had to settle for a bowl of bland, glutinous nutrient soup and a glass of flavored water. Jag, sipping from a steaming mug, filled in some of the blanks while she ate. She learned about the proposed next stop to Bacara and the mysterious source of that information. The source was a completely unknown quantity, and it concerned her that her parents were taking such a decision on faith. Their experiences with the Rin called Droma and his family weren't enough to ease her mind regarding the trustworthiness of the entire species. Given that the mysterious stranger wasn't Droma, and Tahiri assured them that he wasn't, there was still a big question mark over his motivation. If it was a genuine lead, then acting on it quickly could save a great many lives. And if it was a trap, at least they wouldn't be going in blind. She couldn't really imagine the Bacarans allying themselves with the Yuuzhan Vong or the Peace Brigade, though, not given all they owe to the New Republic and the Jedi. "What about Sirtik?" she asked when Jag had finished updating her. "What's happened to him?" Jag's pale green eyes seemed to glint with amusement. "Would you believe he's been nominated for a military honor? Joboth has been really on the spot. Sirtik's a national hero. The people love him. But at the end of the day, he did disobey orders not to get involved. Joboth has to go along with it to save face, but he certainly doesn't like it." He shrugged. "So everything turned out for the best in the end, eh?" "Not for the Yavitha, it didn't," she said, distractedly scooping some of the soup onto her spoon. His expression sobered. "I know. I'm sorry. I read your report. It's brief, but to the point." Jaina vividly remembered the last words of the Yavithan pilot before he blew up his ship, preferring death, not only for himself but for his species, rather than be rescued by aliens and become contaminated. "Run from them if you like," he had said about the Yuuzhan Vong, the destroyers of his civilization. "But it will do you no good. There is no safety anywhere." Even though the tide had turned for the Galactic Alliance, the war had been so long, and they had lost so much, that she sometimes found it easy to believe that the galaxy would never know peace again, and even if it did, it was unlikely that life in it would ever be the same, no matter what the outcome. "I'm sorry about Miza," she said, regretting her snap assessment of the Chiss pilot's shortcomings. What had she known about him, really? Nothing, except that he'd flown well and occasionally irritated her. She didn't know how old he was, if he had family back home, or whether he had someone special who would mourn him. She didn't even know if he and Jag had been friends, but she felt the urge to tell him she was sorry anyway, because she was sorry. "It wasn't your fault, Jaina," Jag said. His hand came over the top of hers in a gesture of reassurance. "Falling afoul of an ambush while simply trying to help someone," she said, shaking her head sadly. "It seems like such an inglorious way to die." "I don't think there are necessarily any good ways to die, Jaina." He'll be missed, won't he? She asked. Of course, he said, for his good points as well as his bad. Jaina nodded. And now the squad is one short. After only our first mission, too, he said somberly. Not a good start, is it? She turned her hand beneath his, locking their fingers together and squeezing. He squeezed back, but with obvious reservations. She sighed, feeling guilty for having ruined the good mood he'd been in. I'm sure everything will be okay, Jag, she said. I know this is a strange way to run a squadron, but once we've ironed out the bugs... That's not what concerns me, Jaina, he said. I actually think we work well together. But if what your mother says is true, if the Vong have been reopening old wounds in order to exploit the after effects... He trailed off uncomfortably. What, Jag? Well... He shrugged and pulled his hand away from hers. There was something on his mind. She didn't need the Force to see that. It may be nothing, but the New Republic and the Chiss haven't always been on the best of terms. After Thrawn... Thrawn was an Imperial. We know the difference. But to us, he was a Chiss, Jaina. The expansionary defense fleet has been struggling for decades to protect our borders. Using the Empire as a tool, Thrawn made more progress in a few years than all the others combined. Yes, he may have overreached at the end, but still, when the New Republic finally defeated him, there were many among us who mourned. That's partly why we tend to side with the Empire. It's not just because we're closer to them than we are to you along most of our borders. There's still resentment. You're telling me the Chiss might work with the Yuuzhan Vong against us? Jag shrugged. No, I'm not saying that. There will always be some who would rather hear a convincing lie than an uncomfortable truth. The right words in the wrong ears might have repercussions for the Galactic Alliance. Great. She pushed her bowl of soup aside, her appetite suddenly spoiled. And that's Uncle Luke's next stop after the Empire. I'm sorry, he said, looking down awkwardly at his hands. It's probably nothing. I didn't really want to worry you about it. There was something in the way he said this that made her study him more closely. But there's something I should be worried about, isn't there? He glanced up, and she could see the uncertainty in his eyes. Without saying a word, he removed something from his pocket and placed it on the table between them. Jaina felt her stomach frost the moment she looked down and saw it. The last time she had seen anything like this had been on the world ship around Mirkur, before Anakin had died. There had been Yuuzhan Vong temples there, some larger than most cities. Each had featured gruesome effigies to their cruel and insatiable gods. One in particular stood out. In her worst nightmares, like the one she'd recently awakened from, she saw a particular face looming at her out of the dark, graven from coral slabs that rose scores of meters high into the air. The fact that this particular image was made from a silvery, bone-like substance and was barely larger than her thumb didn't matter. The face was the same. It was Yun Yamka, the Slayer. Jaina looked up at Jag. He was watching her closely. "Where did you get this?" she asked, unable to keep the anger and disgust from her voice. It took all of her effort to resist snatching the thing from the table and throwing it down a garbage chute. It was an abomination, an incitement to horror. As far as she was concerned, no sane individual would ever want to own such a thing. "Where did it come from?" There was no escaping the accusation in her tone. "It came from Tahiri," he said with some apology. She dropped it when she collapsed on Galantos. The frost quickly spread to Jaina's heart, and for the longest time she didn't know what to say. The Kufi came up so quickly that Shun Mai didn't even have a chance to see it. With the blade across his throat, he was dragged back into the crack leading from the anonymous sub-basement to the access tunnel that led deeper into the underground. "Who has betrayed us?" hissed a voice in his ear. "Who sent the warriors to kill Ipan and Nirit?" Shun Mai flailed wildly, but was unable to break free. The blade of the kufi was so sharp he didn't even realize it had cut him until he felt the blood trickling down his chest. He stopped wriggling then, panting heavily and fearfully. "Kunra!" he called out, but the word came out as barely more than a gasp. The shamed warrior stood nearby in the center of the basement, unmoved by Shun Mai's plea for assistance. Instead of coming to his help, Kunra merely folded his arms across his chest to watch coldly.
"Who has betrayed us?"
Shun Mai's attacker repeated, allowing the kufi to bite a little deeper into the flesh.
"It wasn't me,"
Shun Mai cried desperately, realizing that no one would be coming to his aid.
"I swear it wasn't."
In an instant, the kufi was gone, and a knee in his back pushed him sprawling to the ground. He pressed at the cut on his throat with his hand, fearful that his lifeblood was flowing away.
"You'll live,"
growled the one who had cut him. The figure stepped from the shadows to loom over him. The kufi was held menacingly by his side, its blade darkened with Shun Mai's blood.
"And you will tell me what you know."
Shun Mai stared up into the horrible one-eyed visage.
"Amorn?"
His voice trembled. Nomanor nodded slowly, pinching the kufi blade between two fingers and wiping the blood from it. "But this is no time for reacquainting ourselves," he said. "You have 10 seconds to tell me what I want to hear, or this blade will open your veins and drink from your filthy—"
"It wasn't me, I swear,"
the shamed one repeated frantically.
"It wasn't any of us. The warriors weren't looking for Nirit or the others. They were looking for thieves. Supplies had gone missing, and they guessed that one of the underground groups was responsible. Yours was the third they hit that night. They wiped all of them out. Not just you, not just Nirit. We didn't know in advance, so we couldn't warn you. It happened too quickly."
Shun Mai scrabbled desperately backward in the dirt as Nomanor loomed over him.
"I'm telling you the truth, please."
"We're making too much noise," said Kunra, who still hadn't moved. Nomanor ignored him.
"Just thieves," he hissed.
"Nothing to do with the heresy, nothing to do with me."
"No, just thieves."
Shun Mai continued to back away from Nomanor.
"I wouldn't lie to you, Amorn. I'm telling the truth."
The kufi disappeared as Nomanor fixed the whimpering, shamed one with a look of distaste.
"Do not ever call me that again,"
he said.
"It is a name that belongs to someone else."
Weak with relief, Shun Mai slumped against a wall while his attacker moved away to think.
"Not the heresy, not me."
Nomanor's mind spun. All through their long ascent to the basement levels, he had felt safe assuming that the attack had been politically motivated, if not against him, then certainly against the ideas Ipan was propagating. Kunra had set up the meeting with Shun Mai as the first attempt to find out who had betrayed them. And when they knew who it was, Nomanor would have killed without hesitation. But if he hadn't been betrayed, if the attack had simply been a case of bad luck, then that changed everything. Neither the heresy nor he was being actively hunted. He could breathe easier for a while, could stop imagining regiments of warriors at every turn waiting to ambush him. He could pause long enough to think and decide what needed to be done next. He almost chuckled aloud at the irony. The warriors might not have been hunting him specifically, but it was still he who had brought death to Nirit and the others. He and Ipan had been stealing with some regularity from the upper levels, using access codes he remembered from his years as an executor. The thefts clearly had not gone unnoticed, and the killing party had been sent into the underground to mop up anyone likely to be responsible. He had brought death down upon those who had saved his life, just as surely as the warriors who had actually wielded the amphistaffs. He looked at Kunra. Through the gloom, he could see the ex-warrior's stoic expression, and wondered if, behind that impassive stare, he wasn't coming to the same conclusions. Nomanor stepped forward and extended a hand to Shun Mai, who eyed it uncertainly for a moment before nervously taking it and allowing himself to be helped to his feet. resisting the powerful urge to stab Shunmai through the heart, then dispatch Kunra just as quickly. Nomanor manufactured an expression of relief and let it wash over him. "We are safe, then," he said, speaking as much to Kunra as to Shunmai. "If what you say is true, then the warriors won't be hunting us. As long as the thefts cease, we should be able to live unharmed, yes?" "There have been no more thefts," said Shunmai, nodding. "The way of the Jedi is safe. No one has betrayed us, and no one will. You have seen yourself the way we spread the message. You know that we are careful who we choose to hear it. The word is safe." The message. Nomanor paced across the room, conscious of Kunra's eyes tracking him every step of the way. He had heard the Jedi heresy referred to as the message on occasions before, and thought it a suitable euphemism. Whichever word was being obscured, Jedi, insurrection, hope, the nature of it was the same. The message was anathema to Shimra, and that was all that mattered to Nomanor. But it was becoming increasingly clear to him that at this rate the message would never reach Shimra directly. It had been irrelevant to the warriors who would attack the communities in the underworld of Yuuzhan'tar. Heretics, if the warriors even knew they existed, ranked lower than thieves in terms of priorities. For the message, as well as Nomanor, to reach Shimra, it would have to break out of the underground, and it would have to do it soon. "Perhaps we are too careful," he said, thinking aloud and testing their responses as he spoke. "We hold our revelations close to our chests, much like the priests guard their secrets. We hide the light under cloaks of fear and timidity, so that no one else may see it. As long as we continue preaching to the converted, we will never grow, never be strong like the Jedi are strong. The millions like us who deserve to know that there is a better way to live, a freedom that counters everything we have ever been taught, they will remain forever in the darkness. Perhaps the time has come, my friends, to shine our light into the darkness." Shunmai looked even more nervous than before.
"But if we speak openly about the Jedi, we will be killed."
"You're right, Shunmai," Nomanor said, turning to face him in the shadows. "We would be killed. Therefore, we must find new ways to spread the message, to recruit new followers. But we must expand only through the ranks of the shamed ones before we dare take our message higher up. As we stand now, we are weak and poorly organized. We will never make a difference like this. We must find strength and take our fate into our own hands. And when we are strong, then we may break free." He came to stand in front of Shunmai and placed his hands on his shoulders. The shamed one continued to tremble beneath his grip. "To gain everything, my friend, we must risk everything." His one eye bored deep into Shunmai's own eyes until the shamed one had to turn away in discomfort. "Are you with me?" Nomanor whispered close to Shunmai's ear. The shamed one nodded uneasily.
I shall do what I can, of course," he said. "I don't know how to fight, but I do know lots of people."
"Good," Nomanor said, nodding and smiling his pleasure at the shamed one's response. "That is indeed good. Word of mouth is our greatest weapon right now." He turned to face Kunra. "And what of yourself? Are you with us too?" The ex-warrior's eyes glistened in the gloom. This was the crucial moment, Nomanor knew. If Kunra defied him, he would have to kill both of them and start again from scratch, finding and infiltrating another cell of heretics to turn to his vengeful cause. He might never find one so perfectly primed for the task. The ex-warrior hesitated, shuffling uncertainly from foot to foot. "Decide," Nomanor prompted, as he placed a hand inside his robes. Almost eagerly, the pommel of the kufi found his fingers. Kunra's gaze fell to the robe as he nodded slowly.
"I am with you," he said, "for Nirit and Ipan, and for all of those who have died. I am with you."
But not for me, Nomanor thought. It didn't matter, though. The ex-warrior's compliance would be enough for now. The task ahead of him would be difficult, and he needed all the help he could get in whatever spirit it was offered. The heresy, as it presently existed, was disorganized and internally inconsistent, and would never get any farther than the Shamed Ones. He would need to give it momentum if it was to serve his purposes. Several circular references had developed through numerous retellings. Some stories took place on different planets, with different names, at different times. He would need to refine the tale so it suited his needs best, and spread it efficiently enough so it would eradicate the other versions, if only by sheer volume. It was a long shot, he knew, but it was the only one he had. Nomanor had dealt with religious fervor before on Romamul, and he knew how to turn a smoldering thought into flames of resistance. But did he dare do it among the Yuuzhan Vong, his own species? This was rank heresy, after all. The Jedi, no matter what good they might do for the Shamed Ones, were still machine users. His conscience, atrophied though it had been by years of treachery, continued to nag at him, but not for long. He had tried unsuccessfully to climb the social ladder imposed by Shimra, despite being resourceful and intelligent. If he was ever to succeed, he would have to find another way to climb that same ladder that had refused to let him ascend. Shunmai began to say something, snapping him out of his thoughts. "Amorn, I told you not to call me that," he snapped. He had told Kunra that a time would come when he would need to choose a new name. Perhaps that time had come now. He needed one to carry him in this new direction. Shunmai took an anxious step back. "Then what should we call you?" Nomanor thought about this for a moment. What name should he choose? Certainly one that would symbolize the work he needed to do in order to ensure his survival, and one that Shimra would recognize also. He smiled then at a thought. There was a word from an ancient tongue, rarely spoken except in the older worldships. It had connotations for all castes, no matter which god they worshipped. Its meaning was an unmistakable stab at Shimra, and would be recognized as such by the Shamed Ones he would have to rely on to make the dream possible. "From now on," he said to his first two disciples, "you shall call me Yuuzhan." There was a moment's silence. Then Shunmai stepped forward a pace, his face creased in consternation. "Yuuzhan?" he echoed. "The prophet?" Nomanor smiled, nodding. "The Prophet." When Grand Admiral Pelion convened a brief meeting on the bridge of the Imperial Star Destroyer Right to Rule, 24 standard hours after the Battle of Borosk, all the surviving Moffs attended, along with those Navy admirals and senior officers not committed to the defense of the Empire from the retreating Yuuzhan Vong. Jason agreed with Pelion that there would be a brief period after Vorek's defeat, during which it would be safe to tie up so many leaders from across the Imperial Remnant. Not until the Yuuzhan Vong had regrouped and obtained new orders from Shimra would there be any serious counterattack from the enemy. The strafing of Yaga Minor on their way out had been little more than an afterthought, easily repelled. For those Moffs who disagreed, who thought that now was the perfect time to consolidate their strongholds against both the Yuuzhan Vong and the Grand Admiral who would dare defy them, Pelion circulated a rumor that anyone not in attendance would forego the right to Navy defense. The Yuuzhan Vong was a problem the Empire had to confront as a whole, and the composition of that whole had to be determined as quickly as possible. No one was compelled to attend, but everyone knew the consequences if they didn't. That there would be retaliation, Jason didn't doubt. Beshith Vorek had been humiliated in front of both his army and that of his enemy. Somehow the Yuuzhan Vong commander would return. It was just a matter of how soon that would be and how much of a force he would bring with him. Jason stood to one side with Luke, Mara, Saba, and Tekle, making their presence known but not contributing to the discussion. It was another calculated provocation engineered by Pelion. Luke had expressed reservations about flaunting the old enemy before so many Moffs, but through the Force, Jason could tell that the Jedi Master was secretly enjoying the situation. When everyone was seated, Pelion rose from his chair and stood before those assembled. "The reason I have brought you all here is quite simple," he said, foregoing the formalities of introduction. "I wish to share with you a realization I have come to, and to tell you what I intend to do about it." Pelion walked around the table with hands clasped behind his back. It was a simple psychological ploy intended to intimidate those seated by forcing them to either crane their heads around to see him or stare dumbly forward at nothing as he talked. It was a cheap trick, but Jason understood that the Grand Admiral needed every advantage he could get. Gilad Pelion had donned his full battle uniform, and his general appearance had been cleaned up prior to the meeting, but there was no hiding either his age or the fact that he had recently been on the verge of death. He would carry a slight limp for as long as he lived. "In the last 48 standard hours, the Imperial Navy has fended off the greatest threat it has ever faced." He studied the Moffs before him with penetrating eyes. "You've seen the reports and studied the breakdowns, so I'm sure you can understand the significance of what happened at Bastion, and hopefully we'll have some appreciation of the seriousness of the decisions we must now make." He paused further for effect. "Until we rebuild Bastion, the Empire is temporarily without a capital. The Moff Council has lost several of its most important members, and with them I suspect its short-term cohesion. Many of our citizens have been enslaved by the Yuuzhan Vong, and our borders are no longer safe. But the threat we have repelled is not the Yuuzhan Vong. It is something far more insidious. Indeed, we didn't know we were facing it until the very last, when it was almost too late to fend it off. That threat can be summed up in one word. It is a word that has more fear for me than extinction. It is irrelevance." Jason caught a flicker of annoyance as it passed across the jowled face of Moff Flennick. For a moment he thought Flennick might interrupt, but the Moff remained silent, brooding. Pelion had completed a circuit of the table and returned to where he started. He put his palms down on the table and leaned forward. "When we first heard about the Yuuzhan Vong," he said, "we blithely observed their passage through the galaxy and assumed that when they didn't attack us, they did so out of caution. We were too strong, too determined, too superior for them to risk a confrontation. We believed ourselves to be too formidable an opponent. But when we sent support to the Battle of Ithor, we saw just how strong the enemy's fleets really were. Afraid that we would be unable to defend ourselves, we pulled in our heads and dug in, waiting for an attack that never came." He straightened now, his expression briefly betraying his weariness. "And it never came," he said slowly, "because we simply didn't matter to the Yuuzhan Vong. We weren't considered a threat. We had demonstrated an unwillingness to become involved in someone else's fight, and a propensity for sitting back and watching our neighbors being destroyed. Why should they attack us? We weren't hurting them. If anything, we were making their job easier. In effect, we made ourselves irrelevant, and for that I feel the greatest shame of all." Pelion looked up and caught Jason's eyes. An understanding passed between the two men that sent a shiver down Jason's spine. Pelion was talking about war, but the same principle could be applied to all aspects of life. The greatest crime a being could commit against itself and those around it was to withdraw from the living. Jason had seen this when his father had withdrawn from his mother after the death of Chewbacca. He had felt it in himself when he had retreated from battle to find an answer to his doubts, and he was seeing it now on a much larger scale in the actions of the imperial remnant. Life was involvement. Being part of the Force meant participating in the evolution of the galaxy. It was not just sitting back and observing. The only question of importance that anyone truly intending to live needed to ask themselves was, how did one become a part of that process? Unfortunately, the answer to that question still eluded him. "Well," Pelion went on, "we've been attacked now. No one could have missed that. But does that mean we're relevant?" He shook his head. "No. It means that Supreme Overlord Shimrat took a moment to stamp out a potential threat lingering around his rear lines. A potential threat, mind you, not an actual threat. The force he sent wasn't sufficient to disable us, even with surprise on its side, but it was nothing compared to the resources he committed to Coruscant. Beshith Forik, furthermore, is no Tzavong La or Nos Choka. Had we really mattered to the overall war, Shimra would have wiped us out years ago. Not tried now as an afterthought, but we refused to roll over and be destroyed, even when we were grievously injured. We insulted the enemy as he retreated, and we liberated some of those taken captive. We showed them that we are not easy prey, and that we will not be so easily dismissed. If Shimra didn't consider the Empire a threat before, he will now. How long he considers us a threat, however, is entirely up to us." "And why is that?" Moff Flennick asked, obviously unable to contain his disapproval of being lectured at any longer. Jason could feel the resentment radiating from the man. "Isn't that obvious, Curlin?" Effen Siretti said from across the table. The Moth, recently released from a medical barge evacuated from Bastion, sported one arm in a sling and a dour expression. "If we sit here expecting to defend our territories indefinitely, we'll all be dead within months." Pelion nodded, and giving Vorik time to petition another strike force from Shimra, fresher, larger, and certainly more eager for our blood, would be suicide. "We remain a threat only so long as we remain alive." Flennick inclined his head slightly. "I can't help but feel apprehensive about the alternative you're about to propose." "It's the only alternative that I can see," Pelion said softly, regarding each of the Moths around the table before continuing. "We must take the fight to the Yuuzhan Vong." A murmur of unrest immediately rippled around the room, but it was Moff Flennick again whose voice was heard. "You would have us leave our worlds behind?" he asked disbelievingly. "Undefended?" "Not entirely," the Grand Admiral said. "Every planet would retain a token defense force, at least enough to repel the sort of attack Yaga Minor suffered." "But not enough to repel a serious invasion," came a woman's voice from the far end of the table. Jason recognized the woman as Moff Crowell from Valk 7, a system on the very edge of the unknown regions. "If the Yuuzhan Vong are kept busy elsewhere, there won't be one," Siretti pointed out. "Can we be absolutely certain of that, though?" Flennick countered hotly. He faced Pelion. "Admiral, you are gambling with our very lives here."
"Isn't that what all leaders must do in times of war?" he returned. "I'm offering you a chance of victory, as opposed to the certainty of our destruction. Mark my words, if we do nothing, we will be destroyed."
"If, as you say, we can't beat the Yuuzhan Vong here," Moff Crowell said, "then how do you propose we beat them on their own territory?"
Pelion nodded. "A fair question," he said, "and one that has occupied my mind these last couple of days."
"Go on, then," Flennick said. "Give us your answer."
"There is only one possible answer." The aging Grand Admiral took a moment to look around him, a staged moment of reflection, Jason knew, but effective.
The man was clearly a veteran of these types of meetings and could employ all manner of body language to strengthen his argument. In order to survive intact, the empire needs to see itself objectively. It needs to cultivate a certain distance from its immediate past and see itself in the context of the wider galaxy and its history. We are not alone here, as much as we might sometimes like to pretend we are. We cannot avoid what is happening outside, as the Yuuzhan Vong have so convincingly demonstrated. For too long have we kept to ourselves. For too long have we ignored what is going on out there in the wider galaxy. We have remained content to direct our attention inward, at our own navels. I do not exclude myself from this criticism either, he went on. There have been times I could have fought harder to do what my gut told me was right. That I didn't will be my undying shame, because it was almost our undoing, but I will not let it happen again.
You will not? Moff Flemmick mocked. Grand Admiral, I trust we are coming to some sort of point here. If you have gathered us together to dictate your terms, then please get on with it so that we can vote on your dismissal and put this behind us forever.
Pelion smiled and held the smile a moment longer than was comfortable. There was something in the silence around the table, and the way the moths glanced at one another, that told Jason that Pelion had taken the gloves off. Now was the moment to deliver the message he'd gathered them all to hear. Mara must have felt it too, for he heard her take in a deep breath in anticipation and hold it.
As Grand Admiral of the Imperial Navy, Pelion said, I am formally advising the Moff Council that at our earliest possible convenience we must strike a formal agreement with the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances to share military resources in order to repel the threat of the Yuuzhan Vong from the galaxy. He had to raise his voice to be heard above the hubbub that immediately filled the room. Furthermore, I advise that this agreement be ongoing after the immediate threat has passed. The only way to survive in the future is to turn our back on the past. As much as some of you may dislike to hear it, it is time for us to make peace with one another.
Flinnick was the first to his feet. Join the Galactic Alliance? Have you gone mad? You can't believe that any of us would ever agree to this.
I don't need your agreement, Curlin. Pelion spoke softly, but his voice carried over the howls of dissent. When I say that I am advising the Council, I am only following a formality. This is the way it will be, because this is the way it has to be. I am simply saving you the need to think it through for yourselves.
This is treason, another moth gasped.
It's common sense, Effen Ceretti countered. The Grand Admiral nodded his thanks to Ceretti for the support the Moff was giving him.
My loyalty to the Empire is as strong as it has ever been, he said. I will do what I must to ensure its survival.
By forcing us to submit to them, a finger stabbed at where the robed Jedi stood off to one side. We have spent our lives fighting this scum, and now you wish us to—
Be mindful of your words, Moff Fryborn, Pelion interjected firmly. These scum, as you call them, saved my life back at Bastion, as well as saving the Empire from an early grave.
A grave they dug for us in the first place, Flinnick snarled. At our peak, we would never have fallen to the Yuuzhan Vong as they have. We would have sent them back from whence they came, impaled upon their own amphistaffs.
Do you really believe that, Curlin? We weren't able to resist a handful of rebels, so how would we have resisted the massed might of the Yuuzhan Vong?
Pelion's stare was cold and hard, clearly visible behind the Grand Admiral's bluff mustachioed appearance, was the man who had faced down far worse threats than a hostile Moff Council.
Your reasoning is both faulty and circular, and it is precisely the kind of reasoning that has brought us to these straits. The Empire is foundering not from forces exterior to it, but as a result of its own internal weaknesses.
Our current circumstances are our own fault. It is foolish to lay blame elsewhere for our own failings.
The Empire will never surrender to the Galactic Alliance, Admiral,
Fennec said firmly, and I cannot believe you would ever consider this after all your years resisting their insidious advance.
Instead of responding angrily, Pelion just chuckled. Like it or not, they have ruled the galaxy for almost as many decades as we did, and with less bloodshed and military expenditure, I might add. Right now, they are the one thing that stands between us and enslavement and death at the hands of the Yuuzhan Vong, and it is time we acknowledge that. And we need to do it now, before we bury ourselves beneath old grudges and an inability to accept reality.
I refuse to accept defeat,
Flenix said, still on his feet, and regarding Pelion with undisguised contempt.
And I don't regard that inability as a disability, either. The Empire is strong. We proved that. You proved that by repelling the invasion. Why, on a day when we should be celebrating our victory, are we contemplating the end of the Empire?
First, Pelion said, allying ourselves with the Galactic Alliance isn't the same thing as dissolving the Empire. That should be obvious even to a child, Curlin. They're not asking us to surrender our sovereignty, nor will we. We will simply combine forces to our mutual benefit. Second, as I said earlier, the Empire exists today only because of luck. Luck that the Yuuzhan Vong didn't attack sooner. And luck that the emissaries from the Galactic Alliance came along when they did to show us how to fight effectively. Third, if we don't fight back now, the Yuuzhan Vong will return and strike us down without any mercy whatsoever. If we don't drive them back and join with our neighbors to keep them back, then no one will ever be safe again. And this empire we hold so precious will completely cease to be. If you can't accept that argument, Curlin, then you'll have to learn to accept your irrelevance to the Council instead.
Flenix's eyes narrowed. Are you threatening me? Pelion's response was almost shocking in its bluntness.
Yes, Curlin, I am, he said. Then, eyeing each of the Moffs present, he added, the Council will unanimously accept my proposal, or I will take the entire fleet with me when I leave.
The shock of his pronouncement provoked gasps of astonishment and dismay among those who had perhaps thought that Pelion could be talked around, or at least placated with a slightly softer alternative. No one had seriously considered that their Grand Admiral might gamble the Empire itself over something so outrageous as allying themselves with their old enemies. Jason felt a spike of animosity from Moff Flenick in the Force. At the same time, he saw the blaster come out of the fat man's robes. In an instant, everyone's attention in the room had gone from Pelion to the weapon aimed at him.
"This is treason of the worst kind, Admiral,"
Flenick said steadily. Jason was about to use the Force to whisk the blaster from Flenick's hand when he felt Luke's hand touch his arm. Pelion faced the blaster as calmly as he had faced Flenick's criticism. A dozen stormtroopers stationed at the exits rushed forward with their blasters raised to shoot Flenick down, but Pelion waved them back.
"How strong are your convictions, Curlin?" he asked. "Are you prepared to die for them?"
"You can't threaten us, Admiral."
The Moff's voice was even and calm, but Jason noted that the blaster in his hand had begun to waver.
"We are the Council of Moffs. We appointed you. We can always appoint another Grand Admiral to take your place, one who won't lead us down such a treacherous path."
"Another warlord choking on remembered glories, you mean? There aren't many left, Curlin. Our numbers have dwindled in futile attempts to reclaim something that was taken from us long ago. The galaxy isn't ours by right. We have lost it. The sooner we accept that, the sooner we can begin to understand what role exists for us now. And if that new role is to be part of the Galactic Alliance, then so be it. It has to be better than extinction. I, for one, am sick of fighting a war we can never win, and against the wrong enemy, what's more.
For the first time, Pelion's reserve slipped. Jason saw real passion warring below the surface, like the molten core spinning under the crust of a civilized planet. And it wasn't lost on Flanick, either.
"This is madness," the Moff said, appealing now to the rest of the council. "Are you all just going to stand by and let him destroy everything we've managed to salvage?"
"It's better than being dead, Curlin," Soretti said.
"Or enslaved," Moff Crowell added.
Flanick winced as though he'd been mortally wounded.
"You, Crowell," he said, "you believe this nonsense?"
"It's not nonsense, Curlin," she said. "I argued against joining the Galactic Alliance when the enemy wasn't on our doorstep, thinking that if we didn't provoke the Yuuzhan Vong, they would leave us alone. But that proved to be a mistake."
"No,"
Flenick's gaze swept the faces before him, assessing the expressions and weighing up what support remained with him. Pelion watched patiently as he came to the only possible conclusion. "No." The Moth's certainty faltered, and the blaster dropped. He seemed on the verge of capitulating when a dangerous look came to his eyes and his fingers around the blaster's grip tightened.
"No," he cried. "I will not submit."
The blaster came back up.
"He's going to do it," Jason realized. "He's going to shoot Pelion."
Ignoring the pressure of Luke's hand on his arm, he gathered the force around him in order to act. But he was too late. The blaster cracked at the same time as he felt the flex of someone else's invisible will, and he saw the gun fly out of Flanick's hand and clatter across the floor. The blaster's bolt discharged harmlessly over Pelion's shoulder. The Grand Admiral hadn't even flinched. Two stormtroopers were at Flenick's side in an instant, each taking an arm as they arrested him. He struggled in vain against them, staring wildly at the Jedi standing beside Pelion.
"You!" he yelled. "You and your vile mind tricks have poisoned us!"
"Nonsense," Mara said, stepping forward. "We use our powers to save lives, not waste them. Unlike you, Moff Flenick." The dark tone to her voice made it clear who had saved Pelion. "You are not the only one here who served under Palpatine," she continued. "I have changed, and so has the Grand Admiral. And I suspect that you must have, too, for our former master would never have tolerated such idiocy in one of his servants. What were you thinking? That Yaga Minor would become capital now that Bastion has fallen? That you would lead the council? Don't be a fool, Flenick." Flenick's glare at Mara was cold and piercing, but Jason could tell by the way he relaxed in the grip of the guards that her words were getting through. "Stand down, Curlin," Pelion said quietly. "Stand down now and abide by the will of the council, and I swear that no action will be taken for what has happened here today." Flenick's face twisted as he gathered his injured pride and anger and swallowed them both. Jason suspected that it wouldn't have tasted good at all and would have burned going down. The Moth looked from Pelion to Mara, then back again. "Very well," he said quietly. "I give my support to your proposal of allying ourselves with the Galactic Alliance, but I stand by my opinion, Admiral."
"As it is yours to stand by," Pelion said, nodding sagely.
Then he took a few steps toward Flenick, fixing the corpulent Moff of Yaga Minor with a steely gaze.
"But hear this, Curlin. You have pulled a weapon on me this day. An act of treason that under normal circumstances would be punishable by death. But these are not normal circumstances, and so I am prepared to overlook your insurrection. However, from this moment on, you would be wise to be mindful of your actions, because if you so much as breathe in a manner that I think is treacherous, then I will have your head. Is that understood?"
Moff Flenick swallowed thickly, but didn't speak. He could only nod mutely. With a glance from the Grand Admiral, the stormtroopers released their grip on the Moff. Then Pelion returned to his place at the head of the table without another word. Mara crossed the room and collected the discarded blaster, then stepped over to Moff Flanick and handed him the weapon. He accepted it with some surprise, his brow
increased in puzzlement.
"Personally, Curlin," she said, "I prefer my allies to be armed." With that, she faced the Grand Admiral. "If it's all the same to you, Admiral, I think we should take our leave now," she said. "I imagine there is still much that needs to be discussed here, and given the general feeling toward us in this room, it might be easier for you to do this without us here." The Grand Admiral acknowledged Mara with a curt bow. "Thank you," he said. Then, with a glance to the other Jedi standing there, added, "For everything." One by one, the Jedi filed from the room. Luke, Mara, Saba, Tekle, and Jason. Leaving the Grand Admiral alone with the Moffs to go over the details of his plans. As the rest of the party continued to move down the corridor, Jason paused outside to look back briefly into the room. Already the discussion was becoming heated again, with those gathered around the table gesticulating wildly as they raised their voices to make their opinions heard on the matter of the Empire's new allies. The door hissed shut, muting the ongoing debate. Jason turned to catch up with the others, only to find Mara still standing there waiting for him. "You look worried," she said. He swallowed a sound that might have been a laugh, but could just as easily have been an exclamation of annoyance. "Try as I, or Gilad, might," he said, "I find it hard to believe that anyone in that room will ever really regard us as allies. Despite everything we did for them, they still hold us in such mistrust."
"Not all of them," she shrugged.
"We've made a lot of progress today."
I know, and we'll probably end up with some kind of shallow alliance in place before long, but—"
He gesticulated vaguely in lieu of actually finding words for what he wanted to say.
"Is that enough?"
"Maybe," Mara said. "And maybe you're right. Maybe it won't come to anything more than pretty words from an ugly mouth. But when it comes to the fight against the Yuuzhan Vong, I'll happily take a shallow alliance over none at all."
"True,"
he offered a half-smile in the face of his aunt's optimism. Mara chuckled at the effort.
"That's just the way things are, Jason," she said, putting an arm around his shoulder and guiding him with her to join the others. He didn't resist her. "Sometimes it's harder to make a friend than it is to fight an enemy."
Epilogue. 2 days later, Luke watched from Jade Shadow's cockpit as the Imperial Navy reassembled for its mission coreward. Advance scouts had found the location of Beshith Vorik's rear guard, and Pelion was keen to press home their advantage and push the Yuuzhan Vong back even farther. "You'll require an escort on your mission into the unknown regions," Pelion said from the bridge of Right to Rule, his image displayed in miniature by the holoprojector between Luke and Mara.
"We're quite capable of handling ourselves, Admiral," Mara said.
"Think of it as a gesture," Pelion replied. "A political act rather than a military one."
"A gesture of unity?"
Pelion nodded. "Something like that." Mara grunted unhappily. "What exactly did you have in mind?" "Captain Yage has volunteered the services of Widowmaker, and I have given approval. She's one of the best officers I have. She'll give you support if you need it, but she won't get in your way, I assure you. You can count on her to be discreet." Luke knew that Yage was a good choice. She had proved herself to be very pragmatic and open-minded.
"We don't really know what we're heading into," he said, "so we won't make a point of refusing the offer."
"You never know," Pelion said, smiling. "You might even be glad you accepted it one day." Luke smiled in return, then asked,
"You have the information from Moff Crowell?"
"I have. We'll download it to your navicomputers in a second. She's supervised numerous scouting missions into the unknown regions, some of which made contact with civilizations there. One of her ethnologists has an interest in comparative religions and has recorded a number of myths and legends prevalent among most cultures. One of the more interesting legends is that of a wandering planet, known to appear in systems briefly and then flee when approached. Does this sound something like what you might be looking for?"
Descriptions of Zonama Seacoat were non-existent beyond what Vergere had told Jason, but they knew without a doubt that it could move of its own volition, employing massive hyperspace engines mounted deep in its crust and powered by the planet's core. Luke doubted that there would be two such planets in the galaxy. "Can you tell us where it was last seen?" he asked. Pelion shook his head. "All we have are the stories, I'm afraid. But I can tell you where these stories hail from. Since it's not a universal fable, you might at least be able to trace some sort of path."
"That might work," Mara said, glancing over the hologram to Luke. "If we could get enough information like that, then we should be able to work out where it's been."
"But what happens when you find it?" the Grand Admiral asked. "If the legends are right, it's only going to run away again."
"That's something we're just going to have to deal with when the time comes," Luke said. "If the time comes, that is."
"Either way," Pelion said, "it looks like you're going to have your hands full."
"No more than you'll have convincing Vorik to stay away from your home," Luke said.
"That should be easy compared to getting up in front of a certain princess to tell her that the Empire has changed its mind."
"You won't be talking to Leia," Luke said. "She's dealing with other things at the moment." They had received a brief update of his sister's activities on Galantos when communications had been normalized after the attack. It concerned him the way the Yuuzhan Vong were beginning to mop up lesser threats around the edges of their territory, regardless of the strength of their grip on the center. Even if the center fell, the peripheries could still suffer major damage before the threat was eradicated.
"One of your Jedi friends, then," Pelion said. "I'm sure they have things nicely in order on Mon Calamari."
"Not the Jedi either," Luke corrected him again. "We're staying well out of politics this time. I have come to the opinion that the Force is best at guiding an individual, not a nation of any size. The forces that direct a cell to grow aren't appropriate for the plant as a whole, and are maybe even destructive. The last thing we want is another Palpatine."
"A wise move, I think," Pelion said. "But whom should I talk to, then?"
"Head of State Cal Omos," Luke said. "Or Supreme Commander Seen Sov."
"The same Sov who cost you Coruscant?"
"His reputation is undeserved, as he has recently proven," Luke defended. "And even if it was, we need someone like him to lead us to the right kind of victory. Only someone who has faced losing everything can sympathize with a defeated enemy."
Pelion chuckled this time.
"Skywalker, you're getting more dangerous the older you get. I hope I'm not around to see what you're going to be like when you get to be my age."
When Jade Shadow had recharged its weapons banks and Captain Yage had moved alongside to coordinate their departure, Luke took a walk to stretch his legs and to find Jason. Passing through the passenger bay, he found Tekle and Saba playing a dice game. The human eyes, the faces of the dice, looked black on black, but they were readable in infrared, and both aliens saw well into that spectrum. There was a heady odor to the bay, reflecting the fact that it had been home to too many people for too many days. With Widowmaker along for the ride, Luke hoped there might be more opportunities to stretch their legs in the long journey ahead. He smiled down at them on his way through, and was about to leave when he was stopped by Saba.
"Master Skywalker," she said, standing.
"Yes, Saba?"
"This one,"
she started, with something approximating embarrassment in the way her spiked heels scratched at Jade Shadow's metallic floor. The vertical slits of her eyes blinked before she spoke again. Then, with quiet sincerity, she said, "This one is glad that she came on the mission." He smiled gently.
"This one is glad you came, too, Saba," he said. "Your stunt with the slave ship has done more for our reputation among the Imperials than anything I ever did."
"Crazy," Grand Admiral Pelion said.
"That we are."
He touched Saba's shoulder and felt her thickly corded muscles tense beneath her scales.
"Consider them remembered," he said softly.
She nodded.
"And the hunt continues."
Tekle indicated for Saba to continue with the game.
The Berryville crouched down again, her large clawed hand collecting the black dice and rolling them across the deck. Luke left them to it, glad that the unlikely pair had found friendship with each other. Once the door had closed on the passenger bay, Luke searched the immediate vicinity of the force for some indication of where Jason might be. He sensed his nephew deeper in the ship. In fact, he was about as far away as someone could get from the rest of the crew without actually leaving Jade Shadow. Luke imagined that Jason probably just wanted some privacy, which he would happily give to him once he'd made sure everything was all right with the young man. It was only as he rounded the corner to where the power couplings interfaced with the reactor outlets that he heard voices and realized that Jason was not alone. 3 paces later, he was confronted with a sight that brought him to a halt, more from embarrassment than anything else. Jason and Danny Kui were standing close together by an open hatchway. Danny's hand was lightly touching Jason's cheek, and she was saying something to him in a low and intimate voice. Luke couldn't hear what was being said, thankfully, but just seeing them would have been bad enough as far as Jason and Danny would have been concerned. He quickly tried to duck back around the corner before he was noticed, but it was too late. Jason looked up, and Danny turned to follow his gaze. She hastily pulled her hand away as they stepped apart. For a few uncomfortable seconds, nobody spoke, and no one's eyes met. "I'm sure Mara would have something appropriate to say at a moment like this," Luke ventured into the awkward silence. Jason nodded. "Probably something about not being able to expect privacy on a starship," he said. "I'll leave you." "No," Danny said quickly. "Really, it's all right." She brushed back her hair and, indicating the open hatch, smiled. "We can check out that dodgy surge arrester another time, if you like." Jason nodded once, then Danny stepped past Luke without another word, leaving the 2 men to talk. "I'm so sorry," Luke said when she had gone. "I had no idea that..."
"No, it's okay,"
Jason cut in. Clearly feeling awkward with the situation, he turned away from Luke, shutting the hatch with a gentle push and then affixing the bolts to hold it closed. For a moment, his face stayed averted, but when he did finally turn around, Luke could see that he was smiling. "Actually, you probably did me a favor. I'm not very good at this sort of thing."
"Really?"
Luke said. "You surprised me." "In fact, I'm pretty dreadful."
"Well, I'm afraid you've probably inherited that from your mother's side of the family," Luke said. "That includes me."
"You seem to have done all right for yourself, Uncle."
"Oh, better than all right," he said. "But it took a lot of trial and error along the way. Getting a relationship to work is almost impossible, even without people like me getting in the way. There's no right or wrong way to tread. The rules are made up as you go along and can change without warning." He smiled. "Trust me when I say that it makes being a Jedi look easy."
"Maybe that's why the Jedi of old never married and had children," Jason said.
"Maybe."
Luke thought of his son, far away and hopefully safe.
"I hope Ben turns out to be smarter than his father, or at least more perceptive."
"Hatch sealed," Jason said. "I'm not sure that would be possible." Glad that his nephew held no ill feelings for the intrusion, Luke clapped the young man on the back and led the way back to the cockpit. Danny made a good show of looking nonchalant as they passed, and Jason managed to only slightly flush. Mara looked up as they entered.
"What kept you?"
"We just got talking, that's all," Luke said. His wife frowned at him, but then her eyes widened in realization. Mara studied Jason carefully as the young Jedi dropped into the navigator's seat behind her. If he noticed her scrutiny, he didn't acknowledge it. Instead, he kept his eyes on the view from the forward sensors, studying the ships arrayed around them.
"An Imperial escort," he said with a chuckle. "Who would have ever thought it possible?"
"These are indeed strange days," Luke said, slipping into the co-pilot's seat beside him. Widowmaker was visible as a solid icon, accompanied by several smaller shapes, gradually docking. Pelion had been true to his word, and then some. They were getting not only the frigate, but a squadron of TIE fighters as well.
He'd heard a rumor that the droid brains of Braxton Bonecrusher had also volunteered to serve with Jason again, but they had been turned down. The battered dreadnought needed some time in dry dock before its long-term flight worthiness was assured. Mara seemed about to say something when a subspace message came through, flickering to life on the holoprojector. A staticky image of Han appeared before them, with Leia at his shoulder. "Hey, kid," Han said pleasantly, his mouth lifted at one corner, in the smile that Luke had come to know all too well over the years. "Is everything all right?" Mara asked. "Fine," Han returned. There was some distortion to the voice, and the image kept losing cohesiveness, but considering how far it had come, the quality was excellent. "Just thought we'd drop a line before we head off. After this, who knows when we'll get the chance to speak again." Luke forced a reassuring smile, fighting back a sudden apprehension about his journey. The unknown regions were large and contained hundreds of millions of stars. How long it would take to find Zonama Seacoat was impossible to tell, but he knew it was going to take a lot of luck and a strong faith in the Force to find one planet out of so many. "Soon," he said. "I hope." "Where are you headed?" Mara asked of the fuzzy holograms.
"Baccarat," Leia said.
"Baccarat?" Luke's apprehension shifted and intensified immediately. "Hey, relax," Han said. "It's not like we're going in alone. We've got Pride of Salonia to watch our backs. We're going to be just fine, kid." Luke smiled again, and this time it came easier, even though the thought of trouble at Baccarat made his skin crawl. The right people were going there to fix it, if there was trouble to be found. "I hope you have better luck than you did with the Yavitha," he said. "How's Tahiri?"
"She says she's feeling fine," Leia said. "There was an episode on Galantos, but she seems to have bounced back. She might need a little bit more rest, I think, before she puts the pieces together."
Leia turned away then, as if her attention was attracted by something off to one side. She turned back again a couple of seconds later. "We've just had word that Salonia is ready to leave," she said, "so we're going to have to say our goodbyes."
"That's okay," Mara said. "We're just about to leave also."
"You take care, Luke," Han said, with his cocky half-smile.
"You too, my friend," Luke said. "Goodbye, Leia."
"Goodbye, Luke," his sister said. "And may the Force be with you all." Mara waved. The image crackled and died, and silence once again filled the cabin. Luke sat back in his seat with a weary sigh.
"Luke," Mara said, "what's wrong?"
"I'm not sure," he said. "These goodbyes just feel different somehow." His wife's hand came over to rest on top of his.
"We'll see them again soon enough," she said. "You'll be fine once we get going."
Her hand left his and joined the other, flickering over the controls, completing her pre-flight checks. Luke smiled at her reassuring words, but they didn't convince him. Something was still troubling him, and he couldn't quite put a finger on it. Was it just the mention of Baccarat? Or had it been the look on Leia's face when he'd asked about Tahiri? "She might need a little bit more rest," Leia had said, "before she puts the pieces together." Together, not back together. Yet he hadn't spoken to Leia about Tahiri before they'd left. His gut feeling was that there was nothing to worry about in the long run, but Leia had looked concerned. He wasn't sure what to make of that. Most probably, he decided, his unease came from seeing Ben by hologram earlier, the harsh reminder that his son was growing up fast, thousands of light years away, while he was off on some crazy mission to find something that might not even exist. He could only hold tight to the faith that Vergere had known what she was talking about, because if she did, the fate of more than just Ben could be at stake. Word came over the comm unit that the last of the TIE fighters had just docked in Widowmaker's flight deck. "We're ready when you are," Mara said, then turned to him. R2 was laid in a course for a planet called Yashuvu. Luke's much-traveled R2 unit whistled confirmation from the droid station behind them. Imperial First Contact Specialists listed as non-hostile,
and our specialist in comparative religions has listed it as one of the places that's heard of Zonamas Ikot.
Our specialist? Luke echoed.
Mara looked up at him. Dr. Soren Hegarty, she said.
You did know she was coming along, didn't you?
Luke shrugged. Never heard of her, actually.
She was flown in from Valk 7 especially to advise us on local folklore that might help us trace Zonamas Ikot, Mara said. Captain Yage assured me that you knew about this.
They exchanged a long glance before Luke finally laughed.
Sounds to me as though someone might be trying to play both ends against the middle, he said.
Still, it should stop the trip from becoming boring, don't you think?
Mara didn't smile, but he could see amusement in his wife's deep green eyes.
Widowmaker is at your command, Captain Yage said when the frigate's hyperdrive engines had cycled through a routine warm-up sequence. Course laid in, all systems green. Just say the word, Mara.
Mara glanced at Luke, who nodded.
She relayed the command, and Luke settled back into the co-pilot's seat, not needing to do anything with her and R2-D2 at the controls. The stars ahead were bright and too numerous to count. Somewhere within their far-flung tangle was a single world that might be the key to ending the war with the Yuuzhan Vong.
We're going to find you, Zonamas Ikot, he thought to himself. Wherever you are, we're going to find you.
Engines surged, and the stars stretched into lines as hyperspace enfolded them. They were on their way again.